Today is August 25th, 2007, and this is the Apple Weekly Report, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, morning editor for TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at awr@macobserver.com or phone 206-202-0647.
This week brought us a mixed bag of news. Mac gamers can finally steer clear of Windows when playing games from Electronic Arts, and Steve Jobs is being inducted into the California Hall of Fame. Apple, Microsoft, and Dell got caught editing Wikipedia entries. Paramount and DreamWorks joined the HD DVD camp, and YouTube began running ads with videos. In iPhone news, AT&T bills went on a diet. Apple was hit with yet another lawsuit. Carrier negotiations are underway in Europe and South Korea, and an iPhone hack surfaced that frees the phone from AT&T.
First up, thanks for the comments from our listeners on our ever-improving sound quality. We very much appreciate it. We just about have our new recording routine in place, and we're just about happy with the results from that. Our mic pops are gone, the background noise has been banished, and our publishing schedule, or our air date schedule, as the case may be, is just about back to normal.
It is. I'm totally happy with where our audio quality has been going. I think it sounds so much better. Also, I'm really pleased that we've had so many listeners sending us their comments and suggestions. Thanks, and keep it up.
Yeah, definitely keep it up. And I think that you're going to hear this one. When you hear it is another issue, but this one will be posted on Saturday again. This will be our second Saturday in a row, back to where we should be. So huzzas all the way around. Thanks again for everyone who stuck with us, and thanks to everyone who sent us in their suggestions and everything else.
Yes.
All right, let's hit the news. It was only a month or so late, but the promised Mac-compatible video games from Electronic Arts finally appeared. Battlefield 2142, Need for Speed Carbon, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, and Command and Conquer 3, Tiberium Wars. They are all scheduled to hit the store shelves on Tuesday, August 28th, and Tiger Woods PGA Tour 08 and Madden NFL 08 should be available in September or October. EA originally announced that it was porting several of its popular titles to Mac OS X back at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference in June. The company committed to releasing the Mac versions in July, but that continued to slip, and the lack of any information coming out of EA left many gamers wondering if Mac games were coming at all. Now it looks like the games will make it into users' hands and computers before September.
California is honoring Apple CEO and co-founder Steve Jobs, but unlike the company's other co-founder, he isn't getting a street named after him. Instead, Mr. Jobs is being inducted into the California Hall of Fame. He's one of 13 inductees for 2007 that include the likes of Ansel Adams, Milton Berle, John Steinbeck, and Tiger Woods. All of the living inductees will be at a special ceremony on December 5th, where the governator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, will award them commemorative medals.
Virgil Griffith, a graduate student at the California Institute of Technology, called foul on Apple, Microsoft, Dell, and several other organizations this week for intentionally editing Wikipedia entries to improve their own image or hamper each other's. Mr. Griffith developed a tool that tracks changes made to Wikipedia entries back to the originating source and showed that some 2.6 million organizations have performed about 34.4 million edits. Apple and Microsoft both added negative comments to each other's entries, while Dell deleted negative customer service comments and removed entries that mentioned the company's practice of outsourcing work to third-party countries. Other organizations that altered Wikipedia entries include the CIA, congressional offices, that's various congressional offices, and Diebold.
Paramount and DreamWorks Animation sold out to HD DVD to the tune of $150 million U.S. dollars in cash and promotional guarantees. Rob Moore, Paramount president of Worldwide Marketing and Distribution, said the deal was made with consumers' best interests in mind and that HD DVD is a better all-around choice compared to the competing Blu-ray format. He said, quote, "What is most important to consumers is how much they are paying, and HD DVD is simply less expensive," end quote. Blu-ray backers called the deal an act of desperation on the part of the HD-DVD consortium, and Blu-ray appears to have taken the lead in the battle for the next DVD standard, and some companies, including Target and Blockbuster, don't even carry HD-DVD products. Paramount's sellout may, however, be short-lived. The company signed only an 18-month deal, and any movies Steven Spielberg directed are free to be released on both Blu-ray and HD-DVD.
YouTube entered the commercial age this week by adding in video advertisements to some of the offerings on its website. Included instead of the lead-in videos that other sites use, however, YouTube will offer semi-transparent overlays that appear at the bottom of videos. The overlays will fill the bottom 20% of the video player window and will appear for about 10 seconds after a video begins playing. Viewers can click the overlays to see full ads and will be returned to the original video they were watching once the ad finishes running. If users don't click the ads, they fade away. The ads won't appear on all videos, but they will be available for both commercial and user-generated content.
Apple's legal team cracked down on websites this week for displaying supposedly leaked images of the next iteration of the iPod Nano. The sites removed the images at Apple's request and took that to indicate the photos were real. The images showed what has come to be known as the Fat Nano, thanks to its squat square shape that looks decidedly un-Ive-like. According to rumors, the Fat Nano can play videos just like the full-size iPod and will come in several muted colors.
Switching to iPhone news, AT&T decided to switch the default billing option for paper bills that iPhone customers receive. The company has moved from the itemized versions customers had been getting to a more streamlined version that should use far less paper. The decision follows in the wake of user complaints about absurdly large bills that in some cases ran to 300 pages. The long bill listed every data transaction made on users' phones, including text messages, web browsing, voicemail, and email activities. If you still need the longer itemized version of the bill, just dial 611 on your phone.
Another class action suit has been filed against Apple over the iPhone battery, and this time the case was filed in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California on behalf of Sidney Leung. And like the previous suit, claims that Apple failed to let users know that the iPhone battery is not user replaceable. The first case like this was filed by one Jose Trujillo in July. Apple has not commented on either case, but the company website does include information about replacing the iPhone battery.
You know, I'm going to interrupt our regular news right here and come up with a new AWR standard. I'm going to give Mr. Trujillo and Mr. Leung the Chucklehead Award. Are you all right with that?
I'm totally fine with that.
The Chucklehead Award. We're going to start awarding the Chucklehead Award to anyone that we think is a chucklehead, including anybody who's numbnut enough to be involved in these kinds of suits. All right, back to our news. Negotiations for the exclusive rights to carry the iPhone are ongoing in Europe and in South Korea now as well. France Telecom and its mobile phone division, Orange, are still negotiating with Apple, as are several other companies. Louis Pierre, CEO of Orange, went so far as to tell the press he thinks the odds are against the official carrier announcement being made at the Apple Expo in Paris in September. Presumably, Apple is still negotiating with carriers for deals in Germany and the United Kingdom as well. In South Korea, KT Freetel is in talks with Apple in hopes of getting the deal to carry the iPhone in that country. Apple is planning on releasing the iPhone in Europe before the end of 2007 and start in the Asian market sometime in 2008.
And finally, George Holtz, a New Jersey teenager, spent his summer vacation hacking the iPhone so it can be used on other carriers besides AT&T. The process is definitely not for the faint of heart, since it involves both software changes and physically altering the iPhone circuit boards with a soldering iron. His hacked iPhone seems to work just fine on the T-Mobile network, and you had a chance to try it for yourself as Mr. Holtz listed it on eBay. Bidding for the phone reached seemingly legitimate heights above $22,000 before reaching hoax levels of more than $99 million when Mr. Holtz pulled the auction.
In a follow-up post made on his iPhone-related blog, the 17-year-old Mr. Holtz announced to the world, and I quote, "I'll trade it for a sweet Nissan 350Z and 3 8-gig iPhones. Woo!" All right, we added the woo part. That's right, a sweet car that retailed somewhere between a sweet $27,000 and a sweeter still $41,000, along with three new 8-gig iPhones that he can play with till his heart's content.
Sweet! And not bad for a summer spent with a soldering iron and a few kegs of Mountain Dew.
Not bad indeed, and very sweet indeed. And who is savvy enough to pay that much for a hacked iPhone? Terry Dadone, we're assuming that's how we pronounce his name. The founder of Certicel, a company that specializes in reinitializing and, quote, certifying, unquote, used cell phone batteries. That's right, the cell phone batteries that you've disposed of, they'll go ahead and reinitialize and certify those again.
Sweet.
And the world marches on. It's time for the Context Machine, where Jeff and I delve a little more deeply into the news to provide context for what's going on, and I can't wait to go ahead and dig into the hacked iPhone.
What's the best way to start? I've got it. Holy crap.
Oh, no, I've got a better way.
What is going on?
I've got a better way. Sweet.
All right, sweet. But what is up with this? I mean, holy crap, this kid just got a 20-some-odd thousand-dollar car and three $600 iPhones out of this whole deal.
You know, my guess is that the 350Z is used. We don't know. He didn't say. He only described it as being sweet. And I don't know why that tickles my fancy so much, but it just, to me, it kind of really reflects the age of the young man who wrote the description, and I just find it funny. But so the car is probably used, but it is still probably worth at least $20,000, maybe a little bit more. And you know, and you got his 3 8-gig iPhones, that's another $1,500. And you know, I mean, congratulations to him. First of all, you know, huzzah that he did something that's pretty amazing in my opinion. I think he had the help of some Russian programmers that helped him. But I don't know, man. I don't understand why the phone is worth that much to anyone, but you know, I guess that's what the free market's all about, huh?
There you go. That's capitalism in action. And I look at this whole thing, and it feels ludicrous to me that there's so much money involved in this one little thing. But pushing that aside and looking at what he did, it actually is pretty cool that he managed to find a way to truly break the iPhone away from AT&T and allow it to run on T-Mobile. That's a pretty impressive feat in and of itself.
It is a pretty impressive feat. And, you know, we should point out that unlocking phones from a carrier has been specifically exempted from the most heinous of legislation, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, by the Library of Congress. So what he did was entirely legal. I don't think it's going to lead to it could well lead to, you know, yet another cottage industry related to the iPhone. But you know, I don't think this is going to be like AT&T loses its grip on the iPhone at all.
I have to agree with you there. This will be something that people do because they can, pretty much, yeah. I think.
Well, and some people will want to, and
oh,
I'm sure that some people will be willing to pay, you know, $800 for a $600 iPhone that they can run on whatever network they want to. But, I mean, you know, if those kinds of transactions amounted to even 10,000 units, I would be shocked.
Yeah, I think that will remain a niche market. But there you go. I mean, he managed to do it, and I'm sure that there are people lining up just waiting to try it themselves. And as I recall, our good friend Mr. Holtz listed exactly what he did on his blog. So if you're handy with a soldering iron, there you go. You can unlock an iPhone yourself and, who knows, maybe even score a sweet car.
maybe indeed you can score a sweet car. Now we should to look at the implications of this. Obviously, you know, this could lose AT&T a few customers. I don't think it's really going to matter. At first blush, it one might think that it doesn't matter to Apple at all because they're still selling iPhones, but the reality is that Apple is making money off the contracts with AT&T.
Right.
So any iPhone that goes to T-Mobile or some other network is going to mean money out of Apple's pocket in the same way that it'll be money out of AT&T's pocket. But again, it does happen to be legal, and I don't think it's ever going to amount to all that much. It's going to be very niche and whatever.
Right. Well, another thing people need to keep in mind, if they're going to hack an iPhone so that they can use it on another network, they will lose certain features. Visual voicemail is tied directly to AT&T, so if you take an iPhone and put it on, say, T-Mobile, you can still get at your voicemail, but it's not going to be visual voicemail. It's going to work just like it does on any other phone on T-Mobile's network.
Right, right. And do you happen to know, Jeff, how that's going to affect the ability to ride on? I mean, I would imagine that it can't ride on Edge or a 3G style of networking, meaning that your browsing would be limited to Wi-Fi browsing.
You know, that's a good question. My assumption, because T-Mobile does offer an Edge network also, that it would just use Edge when it could, as long as you've paid for a data plan.
Yeah, only I don't know how that's implemented. I have no idea how that's implemented. Yeah, we don't know. So maybe we'll be able to find out for next week's show.
Yeah, we'll do some digging.
All right, let's move on to the iPod Nano picks.
Yes, the fat Nano, as they say.
Yep.
You know, when I first saw the pictures, my initial thought was fakety fake, 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 fake. And that's because they just don't have a look to me that says Jonathan Ive had his hand in that. It just doesn't have that same elegant look that the iPod Nano, and the iPod Shuffle have.
Got to disagree to a certain extent. I think that if Apple was going to make an iPod Nano with some kind of widescreen, that it would look something along those lines. I mean, it doesn't have that finish that a Jonathan Ive product would be expected to have, but you know, I think that it would be something roughly along what we see. Go ahead.
Okay, here's my vision of what that device would look like. Take a current iPod Nano, make it wider by less than a quarter of an inch, less than a centimeter, you know, so it's just slightly wider. Put the click wheel closer to the bottom, and then rotate the screen so that it fills most of that empty space. Then you can use it for music, holding in your hand vertically, like you'd normally do. Or if you want to watch movies, just like on the iPhone, you can rotate it 90 degrees, and then the click wheel is off to the side. That's what I would see.
That would mean they'd have to have an accelerometer that would change the way the click wheel worked. Because you don't want to be... Apple's not going to make it where the click wheel is supposed to work sideways like that. You know what I mean? That's a usability thing that I don't think Apple would do. And you know, even more importantly, I don't think that there's any need at all for an iPod Nano to show widescreen video. It makes no sense to me.
You know, first, why are you bringing me down, man? I thought it was a great idea. But moving on from that, I have to agree that making a video-capable iPod Nano doesn't make as much sense to me as maybe giving the standard-sized iPod a little bit bigger screen so it can show better video. Because you do want to have a distinction between the different products. And that's something that sets the iPod apart from the Nano and Shuffle.
Well, I think that there can be no doubt whatsoever that a full-screen iPod running OS X is coming. It's going to, I mean, basically be probably a similar form factor to the current iPod Nano in terms of size, but it's just going to be full screen, all virtual controls, just like the iPhone has. Did I say iPod or iPhone the first time?
I can't remember, but I know what you meant. You meant, yeah, iPod.
I meant iPod video, right. Full screen iPod video, virtual controls, similar to what's happening with the iPhone. And it's going to be running OS X. There can be no doubt that that's coming, and I think that there's a lot of room in the marketplace for that. But the space that the iPod Nano fills is one that just doesn't need the widescreen video. It just doesn't make any sense at all. So if those pictures aren't faked, if they're not just stretched out Photoshop images, it is going to end up being some kind of prototype that Apple didn't do anything with.
Very possible. I'm going to stand by my original assessment: fake.
I like that. Of course, you know, it's interesting that Apple did request, quote unquote, that the images come down.
That is. And my gut feeling on that is that Apple Legal sent a request and not an actual cease and desist order.
Yeah, we don't actually know because, A, we didn't post them, and, B, we didn't get that request or the C&D. But, a lot of folks were asking or are reaching the conclusion that the mere fact that Apple asked for the images to come down means that they were therefore legitimate. I don't necessarily know that that's the case. I don't know. I'm a little bit torn. But the bottom line is I don't think this product is ever coming to the market. Not like that.
No, I don't think that product's coming to the market. And maybe I'm totally off base here, but my guess is that Apple sent the letters out not so much to say, hey, that's an actual product, take the pictures down, but more to show – it was a posturing thing, I think, to show that they are actively working all the time to protect their intellectual property and all of their designs. And that clearly looks like an iPod product of some kind. So I think that had a lot to do with why the requests went out.
Let's move on to something that we hadn't talked about before, Jeff, but I kind of want to talk briefly about the Wikipedia entries.
Okay.
I don't think anyone should be surprised by the fact that people within companies, and let's be clear here, these edits that were made that trace back to IPs belonging to the companies.
Right.
My guess is that for all the companies involved, the vast majority of them would be people working within that company doing these edits on their own initiative, not some kind of company directive. Microsoft is as stupid as that company can be about some things. For instance, the fake testimonials. Oh my God, was that stupid? Do you remember that?
I do. And actually, I remember the stock image that they included for the one woman that switched from Mac to Windows. It's a stock image I had seen on several other web pages before and in printed material as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that was an unbelievably stupid move. As stupid as Microsoft can be about some things, as inept as Dell is at doing anything other than making computers into toasters, and is bad as Apple can be about trying to control everything, all that taken into account, I cannot believe that even those three companies with their own specific reputations in these various areas are going to have an official policy of editing Wikipedia entries to suit them. Now, it certainly is possible, and it certainly is possible that other companies did have some kind of official effort to edit Wikipedia entries. But by and large, I think that most of the time it's going to be people within a company acting on their own initiative.
I think that's very likely. I can't imagine companies as well established and as big as Apple, Dell, Microsoft, all companies like that would have a team of lawyers that had so much water on the brain that they couldn't look at something like this and go, bad idea, don't do it.
Right. Because, you know, this stuff can eventually come back to haunt you. Now, I would believe that a company like Diebold, I mean, we probably don't need to go off too far on this tangent, but I believe that a company like Diebold might want to make edits like that. I believe that the tobacco industry might want to make those kinds of edits. I believe that both the Democratic and Republican parties might want to deliberately make edits that suit them, or candidates within either party might want to be making those kinds of edits. But Microsoft, Dell, and Apple, I think it's just people who were – you know, gung-ho about their own companies and we're likely just making edits. And, you know, and that's kind of what you get with something like Wikipedia. This is both its strength and its weakness.
You know, Wikipedia is a double-edged sword. I mean, the fact that anyone can add content to it makes it into this incredible, dynamic, wide-ranging online encyclopedia system where you can find just the most incredible things. I mean, the other day, it's a long story, so I'll just cut to the chase on that. I was looking up Droopy Dog, and they have an incredibly long entry in Wikipedia on Droopy Dog. Go look it up. It's there.
Well, sure.
But that's because there's all these people out there that have this information and can share it. That's the strength of Wikipedia. The problem is all these people are out there and they have this information and they can share it, and it's not controlled.
Right. A lot of this information is not vetted. It's vetted by, actually, I should say, it's vetted by the community itself. So the community of editors basically polices itself. I mean, even the founder of Wikipedia has been caught making edits about the guy that co-founded Wikipedia with him. So, you know, it's by no means this shouldn't be unexpected. And I'm glad that it's come to light so that people can keep it in mind when they're looking at things.
Right. And actually, I'm kind of wondering how long it's going to take Wikipedia to get with this guy that developed this software tool that can do all the tracking and figure out a way to incorporate what he's come up with so that they can better automate that self-policing process.
Yep, and you know, if Wikipedia doesn't do it, someone else will do it on some kind of separate site. So that's good. And briefly, let's touch on the HD DVD thing before we get to the request line. What do you think, Jeff?
I think that the specialist that said this was an act of desperation was spot on. I think that the only reason the main reason that this happened was because the HD DVD camp needs to get backers, and companies aren't coming to them of their own accord, so they're enticing them in with incentives like cash and free publicity, things like that.
Yeah, but that sort of thing is sustainable. I mean, it's a Microsoftian approach, and I don't think that the act of paying for companies to come to your format is going to overcome the rest of the market inertia. And I don't think they can pay enough people to make it viable. And the mere fact that the company that who was it? I don't remember off the top of my head.
Paramount and DreamWorks Animation.
Right, DreamWorks. Okay, so the fact that it doesn't include any Steven Spielberg directed movies is very, very telling. And
right.
I think this is going to, the only people that's going to win out of this is going to be Paramount and DreamWorks, because they have an extra $150 million that they can put in their pockets. And 18 months later, if the momentum is still with Blu-ray, they'll just be able to switch over to that and be done. I mean, HD DVD is for all intents and purposes is largely gone.
Right. And you know, the incentive for consumers to go with HD DVD, meaning lower price, when I'm in stores, assuming I can find HD DVD discs, I'm not seeing that price incentive showing up on price tags.
No, not at all. And that nonsense about how HD DVD is cheaper for consumers, that's just all smoke and mirrors. Just PR talk. And let's go ahead and move on to the request line.
Well, that particular riff means it's time for the request line, the segment where we talk about the topics that you pick. Ivan Rozeric wrote in to ask us how we got into covering Mac news, saying, quote, "I get the impression Brian has been covering Apple for a long time, even though he is new to this podcast, and Jeff clearly has some technical chops behind him. But I was just curious about the path that led the two of you to the Mac Observer."
Why don't you go ahead?
All right. Well, my path was long and winding. And just to give you a little bit of background, I started off long ago, just with a general computer interest. Eventually, it led to working in the printing and publishing industry, doing graphic design, pre-press, and technical support, eventually spinning off to consult for the Mac platform, which then led to speaking engagements as a member of what's now called the Apple Consultant Network. And just through all the connections that I made, eventually led to my first real serious writing gig, which was Design Tools Monthly. And then eventually that path took me into magazines and a book deal. And then along the way, I stumbled across the opportunity to start writing for Mac Observer. And here I am.
Well, and here you are, and I tell you, man, bringing you on board is one of the best things we've ever done. You have been a godsend in many, many ways. You bring a lot of technical understanding that I don't have in terms, especially in particular in relation to the graphics and printing industries and all the related design stuff. I'm not huge into design, and huzzah.
Well, you know, I've said it before, and I'm sure I'll say it again. I've got your back.
Yep, you do indeed have my back, and I appreciate that. As for me, I think I've actually written about this a couple of times, meaning that I know I've written about this a couple of times, but I'll go ahead and explain it again. I started off on the Mac platform itself, designing my own coupons when I was working at a pizza delivery place, and I needed some coupons that the company couldn't give to me. And that led immediately to a love of the Mac platform, and I eventually was able to get my own Mac. Shortly thereafter, I started writing some editorials for a site called Webintosh. If anyone remembers Webintosh out there, can I get a shout out for Webintosh?
Woohoo!
And Dan Hughes was the editor and publisher of that site, and he eventually kind of got burned out, sold the company to me. I ended up bringing Dave Hamilton in as my partner, and he's managed the new side of this thing. He's managed the business side of this since December of 28th of 1998, when we changed the name of the company to the Mac Observer. We've been publishing for, golly, is it nine? Would it be 9 years this September? We got 99. Yeah, it'd be 9 years this September, this December 28th. So that's how I got into this. It was basically just writing editorials and having a business opportunity come up to take over the site. And we've been doing this a long time, and it's been just a fantastic opportunity for me. So thanks for asking. We appreciate your interest in what brings us here, Ivan.
So, Brian, now I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first Apple computer?
My first Apple computer was actually a power computing computer.
So nice.
I'm not answering the actual question. So the first one I owned was a Power 100, which was the second or third computer that Power Computing released. And then I had a Power Center 210, and I think my first Apple branded computer then would have been a G4 Tower.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay. For me, first Apple computer actually was not an Apple computer either. Like you, it was a clone. But from much farther back, I had a Franklin Ace 1000.
Franklin, yeah.
Yeah, the old Apple II clone. And my first Mac was actually a Quadra 610 with a DOS-compatible card in it.
Nice, very nice. I worked a little bit on Franklin's back in the early 80s on the Apple IIe and Franklin clone when I was learning how to program BASIC.
Nice. My Franklin, it went off to so many different family members and yet still somehow managed to find its way back to me. And believe it or not, a guy bought it to put into a museum. So somewhere...
Oh, nice.
Somewhere in Colorado, there's a Franklin Ace 1000 sitting in a museum, and it's mine.
Sweet.
Or was mine. Yeah.
Very nice. All right. Well, that's the request line. If there's something that you'd like to hear Jeff and me discuss in the Context Machine, shoot us a note at awr@macobserver.com or call 206-202-0647, and we'll likely include your comment on the air. And as always, we'll close the context machine with listener comments. This week, our listener comment comes from GT. He emailed us with some comments about Apple's LED backlit MacBook Pro.
And he wrote, I just wanted to let you know that I received my new MacBook Pro 2.4 with 15-inch display. It only took Apple 3 weeks to get it to me, maybe due to the new LED screens being in short supply. I only have two cons about it. One, it runs very hot. I have it on a cool laptop pad, and I still feel the heat. And two, I'm having trouble with my AirPort staying connected. AppleCare is telling me that they have a couple other reports on this and should have a software update soon.
Well, I guess that means that we'll be getting a MacBook Pro software update pretty soon, huh?
I think that's probably a pretty safe bet. And it also tells me that either demand for the laptop is very high because of how long he had to wait, or Apple is having a hard time getting a hold of displays to put in them.
Yeah, it could be. You know, I don't know what GT's other Apple laptop experience is, so I don't know if his thoughts about it running hot are relative to other recent MacBooks or or what. We don't know, but I know that my MacBook Pro that came out last October runs a little bit warm, but not so warm that that it's bothersome when I have any kind of thing to put it on.
And the MacBook Pro that I have is the model that came out just prior to the LED model. Matter of fact, I received mine less than 24 hours before the LED model was available.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! How's that for timing?
Yeah, indeed, that's great timing.
Yeah. So, but it doesn't run overly hot either.
Yeah. So, hopefully, GT will give us an update on that. And if anyone else has any comments, do let us know.
Yes, that's right. And if you have anything to comment on, add, or question, send your audio or text comments to awr@macobserver.com or phone 206-202-0647. And remember, succinctness is next to steveliness.
Indeed. And, you know, one last thing. Let's mention that we have the Futurisonics forum promotion running.
Yes.
Any kind of post you make in our article comments at the Mac Observer or iPodObserver.com will get you basically entered into a drawing where you can win one of four Futurisonics earphones. These are high-end professional earphones. You're going to love them if you are lucky enough to win one.
Those are what, about $200 a set?
Thereabouts. I don't have the price right in front of me. I think they're actually retail for a little bit more than that.
Okay.
They're very, very, very good. When Dave Hamilton reviewed them for iPodObserver.com, he gave them a 4-star great rating. So go post in the forums. Go post in the comments. It's all automatic. You don't have to do anything. We're taking care of all the drawing stuff on our end. So definitely do that.
Sweet. That must be my cue.
That must be your cue.
Yes. And that's this week's Apple Weekly Report. Thank you for listening, and thanks for sending us your comments and feedback.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom. Recorded for TMO. And that's all for this week.
As always, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer and iPodObserver.com.